does have a shotgun wired to subject's head.
Hey.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Do they think I'm bluffing?
No, they don't.
Well, I ain't going to jail. There ain't no fucking way I'm going. For no motherfucker. I've got my finger on the trigger, and it's wired to a dead man.
One movement of his trigger finger and Hall's head is gone.
But I'm a mean motherfucker. They aren't going to intimidate me, and they aren't going to humiliate me.
Ooh, how pissed off was that guy? I'll tell you, so pissed off, he held an entire city hostage for 3 days. He made them give him a written promise of immunity from prosecution and $5 million. Is that movie fiction? No, it happened, and I'll tell you all about it.
You're killing me, Larry.
Hello, Larry.
Hello, Larry.
Hats off to Larry.
Larry. Fucking Larry.
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 Larry. Larry, get into bed now.
Come on, Larry. Larry. Larry.
Everybody gets pissed off, but most of us find some way to throttle it down, right? Before our rage gets hold of us and makes us do something we're sure to regret. At the same time, there are few things funnier than some guy in a blind rage, ranting and cursing, making threats, like that guy you just heard. A guy who felt so screwed over, he decided to take the person he was pissed at hostage. For 63 hours. And he did it in such a nutty, creative, flamboyant, and foolproof way. He looped a wire around the guy's neck, then ran that wire to his own neck and wrist so they were bound together. And any attempt to separate hostage from hostage taker would result in instant death for that hostage, because in his arm that was wired to the other guy's neck was a 12-gauge semi-automatic shotgun. When most people take a hostage, they merely point a gun at them or maybe hold a knife to their throat. But as dangerous as those positions are, they can be successfully thwarted. But not the so-called dead man's line. That's different. What made this situation extra fascinating was the fact that it had a character most hostage situations do not. An antagonist. Usually hostages are innocents, huh? People in the wrong place at the wrong time, threatened by a maniac with misplaced rage. Nothing funny about that. But when the maniac is lucid and articulate and clever enough to fashion an engine of death, as this guy did, and direct his rage at someone who may possibly deserve it, well, now you've got some solid entertainment. Of course, you don't want to see the hostage get his head blown off. Well, maybe if he had, I don't know, killed the angry man's kid or something, then hell yeah, you want to see that head vaporized. Guys wig out all the time, and some vent their fury in spectacular and or lethal ways. Shoot up the office, or city hall, or a nightclub, or school. But they almost always end up dead by cop or suicide. But not Tony Caritsis. He and his hostage survived his 3-day siege. One who did not survive was the spectacular and amusing specimen Marvin Heemeyer and his ingenious killdozer. Marvin was a welder and a muffler shop owner who got sideways with a neighbor and the town of Granby, Colorado, both of whom seemed to be in cahoots to fuck Marvin over. They were jacking him around with code violations and zoning hurdles and endless fines and so on, which brought him to financial ruin. And they, being the local authorities, no doubt felt quite secure in tormenting Marvin. It was all perfectly legal, isn't it always? And they were community leaders, finger quotes, and they had multiple firewalls between themselves and those they abused. Cops and private security and so on. And like most city councils, they probably felt invulnerable. I've always worked in the private sector, but a couple of times I've had business dealings with municipalities right here in Southern California. I wouldn't have called the experience an eye-opener. It was more of a confirmation of a long-held suspicion. I was dealing with some shithead on a planning board, and if I heard this asshole say this phrase once, he had to have said it at least 100 times. We're the city. We can do what we want. Let that sink in. We're the city. We can do what we want. That's a low-level swamp dweller who needed to meet the business end of Killdozer or Tony Caritsis on a bad day. Now, if that's the mindset of local yokels, imagine the swollen heads on the creeps at the state and federal level. Power drunk? No, that's too weak. I can't even think of the phrase that would begin to capture their level of imperiousness. So Marvin planned his retaliation over the course of 18 months, customized his Komatsu bulldozer until it looked as if it might withstand a direct hit from a nuke. He covered it with foot-thick concrete and steel armor. Explosives and small arms fire had no effect on it. For visibility, he used video cameras behind bulletproof plastic. He even had compressed air ducts to blow dust off those camera peepholes. He had 3 gun ports fitted for a 50 cal, 308, and 22 long, so he was ready for anything from squirrels to buffalo. Now here's where it got operatic. The vehicle had no door, no way to exit. He lowered the top of the crane, effectively entombing himself within it. He had no intention of leaving that dozer alive. When he was finished, he had demolished 13 buildings in town, including their former mayor's home, a huge hardware store, the police station, the town hall, the newspaper that had demonized him. Overall, a very successful mission. Until he blew his own brains out. Now, of course, government, even local government in some little jerkwater town like Granby, is never, ever wrong. Because no matter what happens, no matter death or destruction, they must maintain power. Job number one is to let the citizenry know exactly who is in control. They say history is written by the victors, and sometimes, if they can't rewrite history, they'll just try to erase it. And though the town of Granby could not delete all the video and audio and press of Marvin's nearly unstoppable rampage, what they could do was order that Killdozer be shredded and then scattered to multiple unidentified junkyards, dumps, and landfills to prevent souvenir taking. Wonder how much taxpayer money they blew accomplishing that. How petty, how stupid, and how reminiscent of Soviet Russia. But Tony Caritsis, he really set the bar for epic-style snaps with a nonviolent and fleeting pseudo-triumph ending. Over the course of 3 days, Tony became very famous. He had so much FaceTime on TV, people felt as if they knew him, like he was an old friend. And since he was getting the lion's share of coverage, his story was the one Indiana and America believed. That he was a good and hardworking American who had been fucked over by an unscrupulous moneylender. Was there evidence to the contrary? Well, maybe and maybe not. For a bizarre reason I'll get into in a little bit. Tony had borrowed some money to buy 17 acres of land he figured he could turn into a shopping center. And according to the mortgage guy, whose name was Dick Hall, Tony had a spotty employment record. He'd sold Pontiacs for a while. But they lent him the money anyway because they found him likable. Wonder how likable Tony seemed once he had Dick's head wired to that 12-gauge. So the story picks up where Tony takes Dick out on the icy streets of Indianapolis, screaming like a maniac. And Dick, he never says a thing. He has this trance-like look on his face. And the cops just helplessly follow the two of them around town. At one point, they both slip on the icy sidewalk, and everybody thinks it's boom time. But miraculously, the gun does not go off. There's no way that Tony Caritza's situation would develop in today's America. Cops would cap Tony immediately, who, of course, would blast Dick with a shotgun, and they'd say, they had to sacrifice Dick for the public safety. Can't have a guy walking the streets with a loaded shotgun, even if it's being backstopped by somebody's skull. It was a different world in 1977. Part of what made Tony so captivating was how clear-headed he was through his rage. Often hostage takers are high and or drunk and incoherent. And not Tony. Tony made himself understood like a Paris Island D.I. And he had the same degree of confidence and swagger. You knew, and the cops knew, and especially Dick Hall knew, that Tony was not bullshitting. That he had thought this through, that he was calling the shots. And then if anyone tried any funny or heroic shit, the hostage would be headless. And of course, the moment he might waste the hostage, the cops would kill Tony. And it was also clear Tony was just fine with that. That level of commitment engenders respect and wariness. Unlike the killdozer guy and so many other snappers, suicide was not in his game plan. Nor was killing the hostage. What he was out to do was make the world turn his way, to wrestle the monolithic system to the mat and make it tap out. And he fucking did. For a little while. Who among us has not fantasized about doing something like Tony did? Well, unless you're female or some kind of yogi or Zen master, of course you have. People have valid reasons to take hostages every damn day. People marginalized, people abused by a system, people fucked over by a lover or a friend or a company or the government. But 99.999% of people do what is expected by our allegedly civilized society. They go through channels or work within the system. And those people, more times than not, wind up with nothing to show for their law-abiding behavior. Sometimes they wind up with migraines or stomach cancer or a stroke or bankrupt with that gut-gnawing feeling that lingers for weeks or even years and casts a pall over every aspect of their lives. Life coaches and New Age sages and priests and pastors and gurus of every stripe are very big on forgiveness. Are you down with that? If somebody wrongs you and is truly remorseful, okay, you can forgive them. But if someone or something, like a system or a corporation, screws you over, are you supposed to forgive a fucking inanimate entity? But then, there is always somebody at that school or company or government agency who is setting policy, a policy that has fucked up your life. So there really always is someone responsible for your situation. But today, how would you even know who to go after? This Indianapolis thing happened over 40 years ago. If Tony's loan was called today, where would he go to exact his vengeance? Is there even a live human being at Quicken or Rocket Loans? Do they even have a physical address? Lots of digital giants don't even have a published phone number. In Tony's day, The lone guy was in an office building right there in town. It was pre-9/11, and you could pretty much walk into any business unchallenged. Now, online purveyors of everything operate in the electronic ether, a virtual world, and you have no idea who is fucking you over. You send an email to customer service, and you're answered by a bot. Not too long ago, there was a headline-grabbing case of some Middle Eastern woman who made a living doing YouTube fitness videos. And for some unexplained reason, YouTube demonetized her channel. And she tried to work with the system, which netted her nothing but curt, boilerplated replies, which is the imperious way Silicon Valley operates, as if they are gods. And so, pushed to the breaking point, she drove up to San Bruno and blasted 3 random YouTube employees and then shot herself dead. Now, none of her victims died, and the gods of Silicon Valley quickly closed ranks. Dorsey, Bezos, Cook, several from Google, they all screamed for stricter gun control legislation. Not a single word, though, about their selectively enforced mysterious policies and how they arbitrarily deplatform and demonetize and silence and dismiss and dehumanize so many of the people that make their businesses possible. But back to Tony Caritsis. After he marched Dick Hall around the frigid streets of Indianapolis at the end of that shotgun, followed by dozens of cops every step of the way, he hijacked a squad car and drove it to his apartment, which he had also wired to blow up if anyone tried to breach it. There began the negotiations. The guy at the radio station, WIBC, his name was Fred Heckman. Somehow he became Tony's voice or intermediary, I guess. And Fred recorded his phone conversations with Tony to later play on the air. And one of the funniest moments in the entire story was when the program director, worried about how to edit Tony's fabulously profane rants, said,
"Our program director called him into the office because they were all live on the radio and said, 'Fred, what are we going to do about all those fucks?'"
Well, back and forth they went for hours. Tony was demanding that Dick Hall and his company, Meridian Mortgage, admit that they had rat-fucked him on the deal. He demanded they sign a promissory note to compensate him $5 million for the revenues he believed he would lose. And he demanded the DA and prosecutor grant him total immunity from any prosecution for any of his actions concerning Dick Hall. No charges of kidnapping, assault, etc., etc. And damned if they didn't give Tony exactly what he demanded. Here's the DA.
"The Marion County Prosecutor, James F. Kelly, does hereby confer and grant to Anthony George Caritsis immunity from prosecution with reference to the abduction of Richard Hall and all subsequent acts done or alleged to have been done are caused by the said Anthony George Caritsis."
Well, of course, only a fucking imbecile would think the city would keep their promise. Like this TV reporter who asked the DA this brilliant question.
"Do you think the public would accept a man who would put a shotgun to another man's head going free?"
But Tony, he bought it all, hook, line, and sinker. At the moment he decided to call it a day, John Wayne was getting some kind of award on television, and they interrupted the Duke himself to get Tony live on TV. And in an incredible, weird moment of life imitating art, Tony starts to thank everyone as if he's accepting a goddamn Academy Award.
"A lot of nice people called me in 2 or 3 days and told me that they were behind me. And I want to thank them.
They're behind you.
I want to thank my brothers, Jimmy and George, Mark and John, Johnny Ferguson, Billy Cotton, and the people that supported me."
Then, out of sight of the cameras, Tony disarmed his dead man's line and set Dick Hall free. And just to prove he wasn't whistling Dixie, he squeezed off a round from the shotgun into the ceiling. Then, thinking he'd won all the marbles, he got on the phone with a relative to deliver news of his victory.
Harry, baby, just got the signed paper. It's all over, man. I got $5 million. No, hell, I'm free, man. I'm free.
That's when the cop said, "Sorry, Tony, just kidding," and cuffed him and carted his ass off to jail. Well, Tony got himself some pretty sharp attorneys who used the insanity plea, a plea that is successful in less than 1% of court cases. But it worked. At the same time, not they nor anyone else ever investigated Tony's claims against the mortgage company. Why? Because they wanted Tony painted as a nut. If it was proven that Dick Hall and his mortgage company had screwed Tony, then Tony's no longer a nut. Now he's just a pissed-off fraud victim who took the law into his own hands. So did Tony walk? Fuck no. During the entire trial, the state battled Tony's attorneys, claiming that he was quite sane and should be imprisoned for his crimes. But amazingly, Tony won and was not guilty by reason of temporary insanity. The moment that happened, the state flip-flopped. A judge said Tony was insane and demanded he take some tests to prove it. Of course, Tony refused, and the judge held him in contempt and locked him up for 11 long years in mental institutions. Indianapolis proved no different than pissant town Granby, Colorado. Government is never wrong. Government is all-powerful. Government must always win. Tony never got his 17 acres. He never got his immunity from prosecution. He finally did go free, but only after they carved more than a decade out of his life. On the other hand, he did have 3 days where he made an entire city dance like organ grinders' monkeys while he called them motherfuckers and cocksuckers and assholes and jerk-offs. So there's that. Tony Caritzas died of natural causes in 2005. And what of his hostage? Well, not too long after, Meridian Mortgage went bankrupt. The wheels fell off Dick Hall's marriage, and his life took a kind of a bad turn. He remained silent about his ordeal for almost 40 years. In 2017, he wrote a tell-all book and said his company did nothing illegal and operated within industry standards concerning Tony Caritzas. If nothing, Tony was an original. Whether you think he was right or wrong, one thing is certain. He had brass balls. He certainly believed he was right. It wasn't some elaborate charade to extort money. And he was willing to kill or be killed to prove his point. Maybe the world needs a Tony Caritzas once in a while. I'll guarantee you loan officers and mortgage brokers became a fuck ton more polite and accommodating after Tony's televised siege. I'll bet you grace periods were more often extended and foreclosures were not so sudden. People have a right to feel safe. But should anyone or any organization feel invulnerable? Now more than ever, many people and institutions do seem to be invulnerable, so protected by a legal system and law enforcement and so insulated from reprisals that they can do whatever the fuck they please, with no consequences or risk of consequences. I suppose 18th century France became a nation of Tony Caritzas. They proved that ultimately, no one is invulnerable. Those guillotines were slicing 24/7. They were the ultimate attitude adjusters for the arrogant and imperious. Of course, they took it too far, Over 17,000 heads rolled. Ooh, that's a lot of rage. And to all the would-be Tonys out there, just take a deep breath and count to 10. And if you're still pissed off, make sure you get the guilty bastards and not random innocents. No, just kidding. We don't advocate violence or vengeance here. Hey, thanks for hanging with me once again. Slide over to thatlarryshow.com for more about Tony and Killdozer and guys who snap in an epic fashion. While there, click around the site a while. There are 224 other episodes archived there for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to support the show, and we could use your help, click the Patreon button. That not only helps us keep the lights on, it gets you into a wonderful world of dozens of bonus episodes, signed books, and custom recordings. It also gets you access to our deep bench of senseis who will help you grapple with whatever might be bedeviling you. I will personally answer your question, whatever the subject. We've helped people find jobs, romance, their bliss, and more. Follow the show on Twitter and Facebook. Just plug That Larry Show, That Larry Show, into the search bar and you will find it. I'll see you next Tuesday or thereabouts. And until that time, take no shit.